You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Christian Brim. How are you doing today, Christian?
I am well. Thank you, Sam, for having me on.
Good, good, good. You and I met over LinkedIn, a little LinkedIn connection outreach, and kicked off the conversation from there.
Was that a raw cold call, or did we have a connection between us?
It's a solid question. So it starts as a little bit of a copy and paste. I'm gonna narc on myself here, but the whole point is to spark connection. So once you first messaged me and we're like, hey, yeah, let's talk, that's when it starts. It's all me. It's not a virtual assistant, and it's all me just trying to, if I'm honest, it's really just about connecting with other human beings on planet Earth. It tends to be business professional. And for you, I really enjoyed that we're both a part of the EO network.
Right.
A bit of a shout out to that, I guess. It is a lot more about just trying to connect with more folks on planet Earth and see how we can help each other, I guess.
LinkedIn has kind of become a cesspool in a lot of ways that, like, the people that buy Sales Navigator and DM people and, like, immediately pitch you as soon as they connect, it's like, I don't even really care if you're selling me exactly what I need for free. I just won't talk to you on principle. Like, I don't start up a conversation if you don't know me. Ask some questions first. Like, you know, don't pitch me.
You know, there's so much we could talk about there in good, bad, or indeed, because it's been interesting for me. I don't have a sales background, right? And on one hand, it's kind of like maybe that's a superpower. I don't know, because being salesman doesn't get you too far, and nobody likes getting pitch slapped. I mean, I remember a meeting I was in where I felt dirty. I felt like I was chum in the water. The guy locked eyes with me and he crossed the room and all the people along the way, and I honestly was excited. I was like, man, does this guy know me? We get about to have a real conversation. You're like, what's about to happen? And he just went into the pitch, and nothing mattered but the pitch. Didn't care who I was, what I was about,
it didn't feel good. The analogy I used was back when you were younger and you went to bars to meet people. That approach is literally walking up to the girls at the bar and say, hey, you want to go home and fuck? Like, no, I mean, that doesn't work. I mean, it might, but that didn't work.
Yeah.
Sorry for the profanity. It just,
No. I mean, I don't mind it. We don't typically bleep it or anything either. There's a reason it's explicit on the podcast thing. But you're not wrong. That is what it's like. And even let's say it works, right? Let's say you went to 1,000 girls. Let's use this exact example. Is that the woman? And then also, like, what on to your point on principle, what standard does this set?
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
And 100%. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. So
the alternative is, and this is the opposite of that, is you go up and sing karaoke and just be interesting, and then people are gravitated to you.
Yes. You know, yes. Or you find a way to give value quickly. I think that's another fun
alternative.
That was
the karaoke part. Like, I'm
the
giving
karaoke.
Value. I'm giving value.
Yeah, I'm interesting by being interesting.
But it's entertaining. It has to be entertaining. So,
you know, there's something to that too. I think So if I had one gift that I think I'm all right at, I think it's somehow being interesting enough to find other people interested in me at times. And that's, I mean, it really just kind of boils down to that, frankly. How to Get Rich by Felix Dennis. Have you read this book? You familiar with it?
I have not.
He says something very similar. At the very beginning of my business career, he's like, the only thing I had going for me was somehow people that had way more money, ability, and talent just found pity, interest, whatever it was. He's like, they were willing to to give me a break in some scenarios. So, okay, can you talk about yourself, Christian? Give us your background, and more specifically, not the whole background, we'll kind of dig into that more. What is it you're working on right now? What is your focus?
Well, I have a 28-year-old company called Core Group, where we help entrepreneurs in creative industries relieve their financial stress, essentially, transform them from a feelings of anxiety and fear around their money to having clarity and peace around their money. That's what my company does and has been doing it for a long time. I am currently rebranding myself. I am relaunching my coaching consulting. I don't even like either of those terms, where I'm helping successful entrepreneurs get unstuck. My experience is that entrepreneurs have that are successful, that survive and have success, reach plateaus where it's kind of a combination of two things. One, they have success, so they feel a sense of contentment and like satisfaction, but they still have more that they want to achieve. But then there's also this element of the business grows to the limit that you as a business owner or leader can manage. And so those combination of those two things is what I help entrepreneurs with.
Yeah. Do you find a lot of those plateaus, are they, what's the word I'm going to use? Repeated, similar between entrepreneurs?
Oh, yes. There's very common ones. I think the first common plateau is when you have to hire somebody. And there's a lot that goes into that. From a structural standpoint, from a business standpoint, like can you afford to hire somebody? But the biggest challenge and where most entrepreneurs get stuck, and they could have 25 employees, but they're still stuck and the business is fundamentally reliant on them. They're the bottleneck, if you will.
Yeah. How do you, so part of that has to be something along lines of, I think people in general want to be relevant and seen and heard, right? And then they build, I'll get to a question, but they build this thing, they put their core in and so much of their life in. And I think maybe in their mind, for them to transition out of it, to not be a core component, they're somehow, tell me, what is that bottleneck? At 25 people, you should have somebody in every role, right? Hopefully even excelling at it. So what is keeping them in at that point?
Well, effectively what it looks like is they never really delegate. There's still some strings attached. There's still something that's got to run through the owner. So, they could have stopped doing a lot of the work, but they're still in charge. And they make all the decisions, or the important decisions have to go through them. I think fundamentally that's an ego thing. And the problem is that the characteristics of an entrepreneur to be successful, you have to have an inflated sense of ego where you believe in yourself enough to go do the thing. And you don't listen to the naysayers. You look at the reality of what is possible, not what actually is. And so, we're all a little mentally ill when we start this, but at some point that becomes a liability when your ego is in the way. And the inability to delegate is essentially fear that they're going to screw it up, or they're not going to do the way I want it done, or some iteration of that. But if you cannot delegate authority, and authority means that it's your decision to make, right or wrong, success or failure, you own it, then you're stuck at that plateau. To effectively move beyond it, you have to delegate not just responsibility, but authority.
We've hit the crux on something. I want to zero in on it because it is interesting, and it's almost kind of like an oxymoron and hypocrisy, some sort of like weird intersection, right? Where it's like, if a company's failing, it's leadership's fault. Is that fair to say? Right?
100%,
I mean, ultimately, it's at the top. Okay. And also, in order to get into entrepreneurship, you there has to be a bit of an egotistical, I've even heard it like you have to have an unwavering, totally committed, in a perfect world, almost psychopathic, like, I will succeed. It's not when, or it's mm-hmm. not if, it's when. Mm-hmm. But then also, for me, I notice, and I think it feeds right into what you're talking about, there are these plateaus. And what's hilarious to me is you hit the plateau, maybe even realize you hit the plateau, and then, long story short, you end right back at the same problem, which was the last plateau, which was, I'm in my own way. Again, I'm in a different mm-hmm. version of my own way, but I'm in my own way. Again, I've got to get out of my own way. Like, how do you balance those three things?
What were the three things again, then?
The three things are... If there's a problem with the company, it's at the head. So okay. You definitely have responsibility over the decisions.
Yes.
You have to be egotistical enough to like believe in yourself and thus drive and then push and then, but also sooner or later, if not instantly, you're in your own way from growing. You have put a artificial cap on your ability, which is a wild thought because those are all like, they shouldn't play well together, yet you have to have a happy medium, right? That allows for all three.
I would say generally what you're saying is correct. I mean, you do have the outliers of the world like Steve Jobs, you know, Bill Gates, you know, somebody that is in the right place, right time, has the right idea that the business can succeed in spite of their ego.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But it's miserable for everybody along the journey with them. I think that the mature entrepreneur understands at some point they come to the understanding that the business is not them. And there is an identity, a self-identity that is not attached to the business. Which is very critical because if you don't untangle that thing, and there's some science in it I'll go into if you want to, but like of why that dynamic exists. But if you can't separate those two, then every decision in the business becomes existential. Like if I screw this up, if I make the wrong decision, then I'm a failure, right? Which is fundamentally not true, but that's the perception.
Yeah. Do you see people that were very, very tied in identity break from that?
Absolutely. I am. I'm one of them. I don't. So let me tell you the science here. There was a study done on entrepreneurs where they put 25 male entrepreneurs in MRI machine. And they showed them pictures of their children. And then they showed them pictures of their business. Oh, they showed them a lot of pictures in between. But the interesting fact was that the part of their brain that lit up when they saw their kids was the very same part of the brain that lit up when they saw pictures of their business. So when entrepreneurs say, that's my baby, they mean it literally. Now, I'm just talking about males. They didn't do the study on females. I'm not sure that they're wired the same. But from a male ego standpoint, if you put it in that context and you say, when your kid does something great, you feel pride. When your kid does something shameful, you feel shameful, like you failed, right? Because the kid is an extension of you. They're part, they came from you, right? And so when you understand that your brain is wired to look at the business the same way, it kind of makes sense, right? So you have to, you can't rewire your brain. I mean, that is what it is. But what you do, what you can do is understand that you do have an identity that doesn't exist in the business. Just like you could say, success or failure of my child does not define me. Like, I did the best I could, right? It's not my fault. And you know, it's not your, you're not to get all the praise because they were successful, right? Like, it's them, it's not you. So, you know, that's the distinction that has to be made as an entrepreneur.
That's, yeah, thank you. Cause there's a lot there. And I think there's something to that, you know, I want to dig more, but I'm also like, man, I think that sits on its merits. So let's, kind of rewind the clock here, Christian. So this is kind of how there's a flow that we tend to kind of follow and moving into a little bit more of the standard flow. Where were you at in high school? Like, what was it, you know, were you like, hey, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I'm wired this way. Let's go. You know,
my earliest career ambition was when I was in second grade. I was in love with Carl Sagan. I was all things astronomy. And I wanted to grow up and be an astrophysicist. And if you can imagine, in a small town in Oklahoma, when, you know, the parents say, oh, Christian, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you say, I want to be an astrophysicist. And they're like, what the hell is that? Like, I don't even, right? When I...
How old were you again, by the way?
Second grade.
So all seven, right. Eight. And you've got astrophysicist. Did you go around saying that? Because
I was all in. I loved it. And I still have a great interest in the physical sciences, you know, physics and chemistry. I didn't study them beyond high school, but it's you know, an interesting hobby of understanding. Got to high school. My family had a family business, multi-generational. And when I was in high school, that business went bankrupt. We were in the oil patch, and you know, everything went tits up, and all my family declared bankruptcy and left the state. Like, they had to go find work, and that had a very profound impact on me, not because of the loss of material things, but the cohesion of the family. Like, it tore my family apart. And so when I moved into university, I had this nagging thing in the back of my brain of like, surely there's a better way to do this. Like, that's not the way all businesses go. And went to university. Actually, when I was in senior in high school, you did the tour of the university, and they said, well, what do you like to study? And I said, well, I like math. So they took me over to the engineering department, and I said, no. These people are studying too hard. I don't want to do that. I want something more interesting, you know, a little more casual. And I said, well, the business school's where you want to be. And I'm like, okay. So I show up at the business school, and because I'd given up on engineering without even trying it, and I said, well, what do you want to major in? And I'm like, I don't know. What's the hardest one here? Well, the hardest one's accounting. I'm like, okay, I'll try that. So I had no intention of being educated as an accountant or finance, although I will tell you, I was enamored in high school with Wall Street, the old Wall Street, not Wolf of Wall Street, but, you know, Charlie Sheen and his dad, Wall Street of the 80s. And I thought in college, well, like, I'll be an investment banker. That's what I want to be. I didn't even really know what an investment banker was. But as I continued on that track, in accounting, it's you know, it was and still to a large extent is at the larger universities, it is really just a feeder system to public accounting and the big four or big three, whatever it is now. And so that was the path that I took, but it wasn't very long before I realized that I did not want to do that for a career.
We've talked to accountants that it sounds like they really churn through people. I didn't know the big four by term until this podcast, but I mean, it sounds like it's relatively grueling work.
Well, it's a model. Sorry, my bird clock is going off.
You're good.
The model
sounds beautiful.
Thank you. The model is defunct. It's not working, and the industry is literally in crisis because there aren't enough bodies. But it was a pyramid scheme. You know, the partner said at the top, they made a lot of money, and they did it by working their minions to death until you show up, and now younger generation has no interest in working that much. Like, yeah. You know, but for me, it was very similar because I remember sitting with my partner. It was a small engagement. There were just three of us on there. And I had to work Sunday afternoon. I got Sunday morning off for church, but I had to come in Sunday afternoon. And I was wrapping things up and leaving at 5 o'clock. And the partner was on the phone with his wife saying, yeah, I'm going to be another couple of hours. And I remember sitting there saying to myself, because they kept telling you, you do this partner track and this, make all this money. And I'm like, if that guy's working more than I am, I'm like, I'm not interested. Like, that's no, thank you.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting thing. I was in, it's unrelated, but similar. You know, I was in a company once and it was like the guy at the top didn't make all that much at all. I was like, oh, well, if that's the growth track, I'm good. Yeah. So, okay. So you were an accountant in the big four then as a result of that, as a result of the feeder system. So did you get burned out from that? I mean, was it a dramatic, like, I'm quitting today, goodbye. And
what happened was we had kids. And that is not conducive to family in general. But the clients I worked on, I had to travel a lot, and I was gone 4 months of the year, probably traveling. And I'm like, this is not what I want for my family. So that was what forced me to go look somewhere else.
Yeah. Where did you go from there?
I went to work for one of my clients. Which was a small community bank as a commercial lender, which I thought was better because it allowed me to sell. And I thought I was good at it. I was, and I am. But I thought that it would kind of match my financial skills and my sales skills. So I thought that was a good fit. A couple of years into it, the bank sold to a much larger bank who had a much different culture and no interest in, I'm not going to name the bank, but it was based in Kansas City. I'll tell you that. And I had to go up there for training.
Oh, no.
And I thought I was walking back into the 1950s. You know, this is the 1990s. And so I thought I was going back 40 years. I literally had to put on my suit coat to go to the bathroom. You could take your suit coat off at the desk, but just not, it was a regressive culture. And went into the loan officer meetings and they were, I mean, literally every one of them was a white male. Like, there's zero diversity in the whole group. And I was just like, it didn't fit. So I started looking.
And you're coming from Oklahoma. Sorry, I'm just trying to get perspective here. You're coming from Oklahoma,
I was based
correct?
In Oklahoma, but we had to go up there for training after they acquired us.
No, and I mean, you're not wrong. I'm just trying to get trying to get perspective and mix, and it's just an interesting thing to think about. So keep going.
Yeah, so I'm sitting there being disgruntled as a banker, knowing I didn't want to do it, and I start looking for alternatives, and actually I went back to my original desire of being in finance. Specifically, I, you know, wanted to be a stockbroker, which was as close to an investment banker as you could get in Oklahoma. At the time, there was actually one investment banking firm, and I interned for them in college. But in any case, I started applying to jobs, and there were a lot more brokerage houses then than there are now, and you know, essentially just sales cultures. Like it's go out.
Is it kind of Wolf of Wall Street? I've asked because again, so I didn't have a sales background, and I've talked to, you know, one of my brothers has a little bit more of a sales background, specifically in automotive, and it automotive sales background does kind of sound Wolf of Wall Street, which is like. I don't know. I thought that movie was satirical, I guess, comedic in some fashion.
In Oklahoma, the brokerage scene was not nearly as tawdry, but it was that high pressure of sales. And I was down with it because I thought, you know, if I sell, I'll make a lot of money. And every brokerage firm that I got an interview with turned me down. And the last one that turned me down was Prudential, and the hiring manager called me and she said, well, even if I wanted to hire you, I couldn't because you didn't pass the sales aptitude test. And I literally laughed on the phone. I laughed at her and I knew immediately, I'm like, okay, God, you're shutting this door. This is you telling me this is not the path that you're going on. Like, I know that's what you want to do, and you think you can do it, and you probably can, but I'm shutting those doors for you.
That's good.
And so, yes, I thank God. And I started to just kind of ponder options. And I was looking in the back of the Journal of Accountancy magazine.
How did that feel in that moment, by the way? Was there a little bit of resentment, or was it clarity, or was it resentment? Like, what? It took a lot of, I mean, how? What was that period of time? But it sounds like you applied for a few places. Like, you had a direction.
I mean, that was only like 3 months that I was looking for that job and interviewing. And I mean, I'm going to tell you, initially it was disappointment. And the first two were disappointment. I'm like, man, like, because I knew the people that they had hired, and I'm like, well, okay, yeah. I can see why they hired him over me. I'm like, oh, he's got more experience, he's got more contacts. Like, okay, I can live with that. But I was disappointed. And then when Prudential came back and said, well, you didn't pass the sales aptitude test, I'm like, you got the wrong score. Like, I don't know whose score you're looking at, but it's not mine. And that's when I would say relieved, like I in the sense that, like, okay, this isn't about you. It's not about you and your abilities. It's God telling you no. And I'm like, okay, all right. I can deal with that, but I don't really want to stay here. So what's the alternative? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. One, for me, I want to dive in a little bit into discernment because, in retrospect, and I believe you. You know, you've got more of the full picture now, but I'm more curious because, especially more recently, with my friends, maybe in my church, maybe just I don't know, but it seems like again and again and again, I'm running into this thing where I hear somebody say, "It's God." Oh no, it wasn't God. It's God. Oh no, it wasn't God. It's God. And then it's like how many ideas. Were God, barely tested, now we're not God, now are God again. And it seems to be a semi-recurrent theme. And I'm not disagreeing with them. I mean, I think it's all God. I'm just trying to, for me, as somebody that loves questions, it's kind of like, how do I come to terms with my own discernment? Where's my own moment of, I'm receiving the message, Lord. I'm more than capable, but you said no, not this.
Well, I can tell you I did not have the spiritual maturity to discern. It was the way God dealt with me at that point because of who I was, very headstrong. And, you know, it was one of those things where God had to just slap me like, dude, stop this. This is not the way I want you to go. And it was that way for a long time. And I think now I know how to test what I'm discerning, what I think I hear the Lord saying, much better than I did. But here's the thing that is interesting to me is that just because God gives us permission to go the direction that we want to go doesn't mean that you're going to get the outcome that you expect, right? And so I feel like God has, even just recently this year, I felt God saying, yes, go ahead and do that. But it turned out nothing like I thought it was going to, right? Like it was a failure in that word, right? But I also learned an extremely valuable lesson about myself and my leadership team and how I, and like this transition that I was in as a leader, that I, looking back on it, I think God was saying, yeah, go ahead and do that. You're not going to get what you want, but it's going to teach you a lesson that you need to know, right? So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does kind of, for sure. Part of what I'm trying to figure out, it's the question of like, how do I partner best with God in a way that, like, I don't know. I think, you know, there's always going to be difficulty. That's kind of the point, right? The crucible, the refining fire, the iron sharpens iron. None of that says this is going to be comfortable and easy. But then on the same token, there's got to be this place where surely we can get to a tune in better, I hope, where I could more easily like, gotcha, I hear you. I'll move on.
Well, I'll answer that with a pair it with two scriptures, and I don't know the chapter and verse, so don't ask. But I think it was Proverbs. Your thoughts are not my thoughts, and as is the heaven to the earth are my thoughts to your thoughts. Like you're right, so clearly laid out. The mind of God is not something for you to understand. And then I pair it with Jesus's prayer where he said, I pray that they, referring to us as believers, can be one with you just as I am one with you. Right? So Jesus's prayer, intercessory prayer, was that we would be able to know God the way he did. Is that the same thing? Is the scripture talking about the same thing? Is that the mind of God, yeah, the knowledge of God? Like, was Jesus talking about the same thing that, you know,
I know
Solomon,
you said,
was talking about in Proverbs? I don't know.
I know you said don't ask you, and I'm not testing you. I'm merely curious. Was that in the garden? And I'm willing to feign total ignorance. But I want to go reference it later. Do you happen to have a rough
Old
idea
Testament?
Which gospel? No,
oh,
when Jesus said.
No.
I would assume it was the gospel, right? If it was Jesus' prayer?
Yes, and I believe it was in multiple. I don't think it was just one.
Okay, okay.
But I can't speak to that.
No, you're good. I'm going to search it out,
you know,
for myself.
I think, theologically speaking, I think that Christ's death and resurrection paved the way for the Spirit, for his believers to have that indwelling of the Spirit, which, if we allow it to renew our minds, as Paul calls it, we can actually achieve that. We can understand the perfect will of God. But it's by a renewing of the Spirit. It's not, it's a death to self, and self not the physical body, but that ego. Like it has to die.
Yeah.
And it's not an extinction, right? It's not the death. Like God doesn't want Sam to not be Sam anymore. He created Sam perfectly. What he wants is your will to be subservient to him.
Yeah.
And that has to be a willing transaction. He's not going to force it on you. You have to respond and say, "Yes, God, I understand how much you love me. And I understand what you have given me. And I am going to accept that gift. And the response of that is I'm going to give you everything of me." And I think it's summed up best with Jesus's encounter with the rich young ruler. And it's fascinating to me that he asks a question. Well, no, I'm confusing that with Nicodemus. He asks the question, "What am I, must I have to have eternal life?" And Jesus tells him, "Well, you know the laws. You know, don't do this, don't do this, don't do that." And he said, "Well, I've kept all those." I said, "Okay.
Good to go. Yeah.
Sell everything, give it to the poor, come follow me." So the reality is, it's not just the rich young ruler. That's his statement to all of us. Is I don't care what you've done or not done, what you hold as a belief. What I want is you. And it's not part, it's not conditional. Give everything up and follow me.
So and I let this is what the podcast is about. This is why I try to get to, because we're somehow referencing something that we already talked about just in a different way, which was the separation of your business from yourself. You have a self outside of the business, outside of the thing that you build. And what's interesting too about this is a little bit unrelated, but I feel like at least mentioning it. There's a concept where you take shrooms or psilocybin or, I don't know, play with that weird rabbit hole, but there's a concept I'm just familiar from books called ego death.
I had a friend.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. No, right. The death of self, where you pass through. It's like it's a moment where you have to let go. And I've experienced something kind of similar, not through shrooms, but something similar. And it's me. It's not a friend. Where there's a moment where you have to let go of yourself, and you don't actually know if you're going to die or not as a result. There's a fear that you won't come back. And the fear actually is what will cause a negative trip. But if you just let go, what's on the other side is not to be feared. What's on the other side is not death. Although it's funny because even now, I don't know if I could say that with 1,000% certainty. I could just say that with a degree of confidence, because when you are in it, when you're going through it, you are pretty passionate about the notion that you're going to die if you let go of yourself. And it was interesting how, I brought in psilocybin and stuff like that, but I honestly think probably the most interesting element to that is we literally talked about something very similar at the beginning of the podcast, which was the separation of yourself from your business. And I wonder if a similar sort of maybe lighter ego death needs to happen in that same process. That's what you referenced basically, right?
Absolutely. And you'll find it all over the place, for entrepreneurs, their business definitely, but your kids, it's real easy when they're young and dependent to have your ego satisfied. But when they don't need you and they eventually leave you, as they should, it's an ego death. That's part of you that has left. And but, I think the metaphysical way I would answer that is that energy cannot be destroyed. You as a person cannot be destroyed. You're not going to die. One of the scariest thoughts that I had, and give you insight into how weird I am, when I was a kid, And it was probably because I was studying astrophysics and the idea of infinity came into my brain. And I tried to wrap my brain around that. And somehow that led to oblivion, like non-existence. And it terrified me as a young child. Like if you really try to think about it, dwell on that, it's a terrifying thing. It's because that's the way our brains are wired to protect us. Like it and so we can't even comprehend the absence of ourselves.
We really seem incapable of comprehending scale in at least for me. Like, I mean, you say $1 billion, right? I don't. And then there are people that are like, I don't know the math, but it's like, you know, multiple hundreds of dollars every second or something like that. It's a wild number that we just throw around as if anybody, like billions. Yeah, you can go become a billionaire. Just shoot for it. And I'm not saying anybody can't. I'm just saying that like sales is a great example, right? You know, like your target market and connecting with more people. You know, I'm in a small community in Kansas City called Parkville. It's a small, big community. It's one of those weird ones. And, you know, if I were to make the commitment just in this small, big community to have coffee with, try to have coffee with each person in the community, I wouldn't make it to death. Meeting every single person is not possible. And that's mm-hmm. just in that. It's just the one small community. You go to like the Atlanta airport in the middle of a busy season or whatever, and there's so many people there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I struggle with that. I struggle with taking off in a plane and looking just how big just a city is, let alone multiple cities, let alone states, let alone countries, let alone the world. Let alone what you're talking about, which is oblivion in the universe. Like that's just
no. I think one of the great failings of the age of reason, which I would go back to the Renaissance. Like this is not recent history, but since Western civilization really dedicated themselves to the scientific method, is that this belief, it is a belief that all things are understandable or explainable or at least knowable at some point. Like we may not know now, but if we just keep working the problem, we'll figure it out. But I'm going to tell you that there are things that you will never understand and no one is able to understand. It is not knowable, right, by the brain. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. The limitations of our brain. Can you sitting there, Sam, tell me that you feel the earth moving? No.
No.
Of course
no.
not. None of no. us can.
Yeah. No. No
but
no.
we all agree that it is rather quickly, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's spinning.
And I think most people do. Yes.
Well, there are some flat earthers out there.
There's some interesting folks out there. Yeah, yeah. Now, for some reason, that was the first thing that came to my mind, too. Was so, to your point about it spinning, there's also a curvature.
Correct.
Can I look out on the horizon and see the curvature? Not easily, not readily, no.
Not unless you're about 30,000 feet up, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of my point is that's just a limitation of your brain. And if we were to simply go by our brain's understanding, then we'd say, well, the earth couldn't spin because I can't feel it. Now, that's not the scientific method. You know, you start to observe other things, but it just shows you the fundamental limitation of our brain. We can only perceive certain things. Can we see beyond the visible spectrum? No, we can't mm-hmm. see ultraviolet light. We can't see x-rays, but they exist, right? They can affect us.
Yeah, and there's almost a faith element to it. Even just in the scientific method, because
everybody has faith.
Yeah.
Everybody has faith in something.
So we start to progress here and I'm trying to, okay. So I'm trying to catch up now going back to your story and you're applying for different brokerages. If I recall,
mm-hmm.
the door is closed. We started mm-hmm. a discernment. Where did you go once you realized those doors were closed? And that was a 3-month period. And you're still working as a banker,
yeah.
which you're not happy about because it's an old school bank with old school ways
yes.
from a town that needed a lot more maturity at the time, maybe.
Yes.
And where'd you land?
Well, I started looking through, reading the Journal of Accountancy, you know, the AICPA journal, very riveting stuff. In the back, they have want ads, classified ads. And I see this ad for comprehensive business services, and it's a franchise. And I'm like, I didn't even know there was such a thing. And so I reached out to the contact. Turns out he lived in Dallas and his wife was from Oklahoma City. So we just had this instant connection. And we started talking. And I can't really reconstruct my mindset around it because at this point I had two kids and my wife worked very part-time. And somehow I made the leap that I should get an SBA loan and buy a franchise, fly out to California for 3-week training and put all that on a credit card and start a business. But I did. And,
I mean, that is a leap. What was going through your head? And I do know this.
I can't really reconstruct that frame of mind. I really can't. Like, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
I do know I was thinking this, that I had the prescience to see that if I continued what I was doing on the path that I was going, that I was going to have more and more success and more responsibilities, and it was going to be harder for me to make that change or make that decision. And I didn't have anything to lose, right? Like I literally had nothing to lose.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yes. Yeah. Mine came about the time when we started trying for our first. I was like, well, I mean, yeah, now's the time to make the leap. And flew out to California, put all that on a credit card.
Yes.
How I feel like I understand some of these feelings. Obviously, each of our experiences are unique. What, you've got kids, you're putting this all on a credit card, and what was the pace for it to turn around? Tell me a little bit more about, was that what you're doing currently? Was that the origin story of Core Group?
Yes, that's the origin story of Core Group. I opened this franchise in 1997. And so I get back and, you know, part of the training there for the franchise was sales training and sales and marketing, but they actually took us out into, we were in Orange County, you know, very affluent, and they'd take us out to a shopping center or a warehouse district, and we'd like go cold call on businesses. And like, we worked the process, and then we went back and the next day we'd call and try and set up an appointment. Like, so they actually had us do the thing that we were going to do when we got back.
That sounds like a beautiful franchisee sales training.
It really was, especially for accountants, because in general, these guys couldn't sell anything. So I come back. I had already found an office space. I had already bought my computer. I set up office and literally went and hit the streets. And I sold 30 clients in the first 12 months in the business and was rookie of the year. And it literally was, I think my gross that first year was close to 100,000. And I'm going to tell you, when I, at the bank, I probably was making 40. Now, I had some additional expenses with the franchise, had a loan payment, had credit cards to pay off. But it was really a Cortez burning his ships. Like, I didn't have a choice. I had to go out and succeed. And I did. I think it's impossible to replicate. Everybody talks about that hungry, you know? It's impossible to replicate artificially the way you feel in those situations where you don't have any alternatives but success.
And I think, so I was thinking through, because I kind of knew what you were getting to. I mean, I don't think that's necessary for everybody, but I believe, correct me if you think differently, that there are some people that never would have made it any other way, but that burned the boats, that hungry, I think can make, for lack of any better analogy, winners out of people that wouldn't have made it the same way.
Yeah, and I run across a lot of potential entrepreneurs, you know, entrepreneur curious, or they're dabbling with a side hustle while keeping their main job, and you know, struggling with that. And I'm like, look, dude, if you don't have a fire, don't do it, because there's a lot of shit you don't know that you're going to have to do and learn, and it's going to suck. And if you don't have that hunger, you're not going to succeed, unless you're just crazy lucky.
Well, and I've even heard some people, like the CEO of NVIDIA, but he's not the only one. I feel like I've heard other people say it too, say if they were to go back and do it again, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. If they were to go back and do it again, barring the exact same thing, the question was, if you go back, what business are you starting today in 2025? And their answer was, I wouldn't. Because I know the cost. I mean, barring doing the exact same thing, growing it to the exact same place, I didn't know the cost at the time. Knowing the cost that I know now, I wouldn't do it.
No, I mean, I it was the founders of PayPal, I think, said, because they had no, I mean, they were tech guys. They were not finance guys. And they had no idea about the fraud and the compliance side of it around fraud. And they said, like, the only reason we started is because we didn't know any better. Like, if we had known that, we never would have moved forward. And there's a lot of truth to that. Like, I think to a certain extent, this, if you want to bring it back to God, I don't think God shows us the future in whole because we couldn't handle it. Like,
we wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think you kind of answered my question too, which was going to be, so to pose to you the question, like, you know, going back, barring this business, you know, you can't restart this one. You can't relive this life. Do you start a business again?
I don't think I had a choice. I think it was, I really believe this at my core, that that's what I was created to be. And I don't think I would have, I think it was inevitable. Yes, I do. I think that I never would have been satisfied working for someone else, regardless of how much money I made. I think at the time it was, I want to control my financial future. I want to make more money. I want to make money for myself, not somebody else. That was an initial motivation, as it is with a lot of entrepreneurs. But for me, it was deeper than that, even though I didn't understand it.
So how now, moving along, have you, I mean, we're talking about pretty deep things, faith and business, and how do you feel you've integrated those? I mean, how is your Christian walk better as a result of your business, and how are those around you? How's the community? How's the, you know, impacted by this?
Well, I was kind of old school in that for a long time. I never hid my faith, but I kept it separate. You know, in the workplace with my employees, you know, there were no religious discussions. There were no political discussions. Like, you know, it's kind of like polite company. You just don't talk about those things, right? I have been on a growth journey the last 5 years, and part of that was God calling me out. And part of that experience was understanding that that separation was in my own head. Like, it didn't have to be separate. And if I'm going to be very honest with you, I think the compartmentalization of faith lends itself to, what's the word I'm looking for? Behavior that lacks integrity. In the sense that integrity means you're the same person wherever you are, whether you're in church or whether you're at a bar or whether you're at work, like you're the same person. Now,
yeah,
that's not to say that you don't use different words or do different things in different situations, but you fundamentally aren't different. If you separate yourself like that arbitrarily, and say that, you know, faith isn't going to have a part in the, not in the business, because I was totally fine giving that over to God and having conversations with God about the business. But like the people that I interacted with, my employees and my clients, I made that distinction. And it allowed me to be someone slightly different, right? Because I couldn't be held to that same standard. And that's, you know, what God did 3 years ago. He called me to start a home church, and I reacted. I as I say, spit the bit. I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go that direction. I'd been in a
like a horse, by the way. I'm yes. trying to make sure I understand yes. the analogy.
Like
you
the,
said,
the,
no,
the bit
you
guides
cannot
the horse.
Bridle me. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. I'd been in part of a congregation, a large congregation, in a small Sunday school class for 30 years. And when it came down to it, I was wrestling with God in that decision, because I knew I wasn't worthy for what he was calling me to do. And it scared the hell out of me. Like, you're calling me to be something I'm not. Mm. And his response to me was beautiful. It was a beautiful story. So I was driving on the way to work, and I realized what God was calling me to do. And because this had happened over like 2 years, like it wasn't just a flash, right? But in the moment that I understood what God was calling me to do, I had this oppressive spirit come over me. It was a dark feeling. Like, I would say beyond depression. Like, it was just a dark energy. And I got to the office. I had my scheduled call with my business coach, who used to be an Orthodox rabbi. So we routinely had conversations around spirituality, because I was very curious about Judaism and the Jewish people. And I asked him, because I was still feeling this, I said, what are the spiritual qualifications for being a priest? And like in the Old Testament, like what's the standard that you guys apply to be a rabbi? Like what's, and he started talking, and he was referencing the tabernacle, and it was like the volume was turned down on what he was saying. And God showed me this experience that I had when I had followed his calling before, and I had gone to the high school summer camp as a volunteer counselor, had no kids in high school, was not involved in children's ministry, but I just felt called to go. And when I went to that camp, I was in the building that they called the tabernacle, where they did the worship. And I had an encounter with a living God that I can't really describe it, but it was indescribable. But once I heard that word tabernacle come from my coach's voice, the volume got turned down on what he was saying, and God immediately took me back to the tabernacle. That experience when he filled me. I say he literally, I, it was like I could feel him, like he was touching me with his finger. And I was filled to the point where I was about to explode. I literally was saying no more. Like, I can't take any more of you. Like, but I had the sense that it was just his finger. Like, I'm just giving you a little right? So he shows me this again, and he says to me, he said, you are worthy because I am. And I understood in that moment that, yes, I have to go through with this, what you're calling me to do. But it also made me understand, looking back at this separation that I'd had, that that's not going to cut it anymore, right? I'm calling you to be one person. And that has been my experience for the last 3 years, is I don't necessarily intentionally seek out the conversations, but I definitely don't avoid them. And when it is germane to the subject, I absolutely will bring it up. And it doesn't really matter whether the other person is spiritual or not, Christian or not. It doesn't matter. I will bring scripture. I will bring my experience into the conversation. And it's been fascinating to me the doors that God has opened to me to other people, like people I would never have met had I had that old mindset, that old paradigm. It's not like it's resulted in some, rich blessing to my business where it's grown. It's nothing like that. It's just I had all these doors that were previously closed to me have been opened.
By the way, that was beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. Had little tears walled up.
I was tearing up myself, so I don't know if you can see that.
Juan, I feel like for me, I feel like I've had a similar enough experience in that. You know how I described it was a toenail. I was like
that's even better.
I don't even. And for me, it was your point exactly. It was like whatever I saw or interacted with in that moment to think it was even a small part for me was like it was nothing. It was the bare minimum that he could
all
give
you can take
that had me screaming. Like yes. I don't know. I might leave blind or maimed
right.
or
can
yes. stop here. Can you? Okay. So, but the question I had originally, which was what came up when you were starting to tie the knot on that story, was so. To your credit, though, do you think a decent part of that might be the church, the modern church? Because I feel like intrinsically. At least the way I was raised. You know, you said fuck at the beginning of the podcast, which I'm reiterating for the sake of my also cursing.
Just for clarity.
We grew up, well, so I could say the word too. We grew up in this world where, you know, don't curse, don't drink, and act. There's all these things that you cannot do. And it's not that you shouldn't. I'm saying that's bad. It's more that I'm saying it lends to this weird world where you can't be you. And if you can't be you and you can't be you here, then you can't be you there. Then, yeah, there's going to be two or three or four different versions of you because you can't be you anyway. So,
Yeah, I think Tony Campolo said it best. I heard him speak in person once, and he was talking about his homeless outreach and I don't remember exactly how the phrase, but he said the word shit, and this was in church. And there was like this collective gasp.
Yeah.
And he said, here's the problem. You're more upset about that word than you are the plight of your brothers and sisters in Christ that are in homelessness. And experiencing this poverty and mental illness and all these other things, right? And addiction. Like, and that speaks a truth to me about like what's really important. Like what is it that you do you have God's heart? Does God say shit? No. But that's not the point.
We're not actually doing battle in a spirit realm getting pissed off about shit.
No, that's exactly right. We're talking about people's souls here. Their God image that is at stake here. And so for you to trivialize it by any multitude of things is reducing the problem to something that is just irrelevant.
A distraction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I coined the phrase in the last 3 years with my home church is this the modern church in America, and not even so much now, but like when I was growing up, it's about sin management. It's about like, okay, you know, I can't do this, can't do that, can't do this. But if I do, God forgives me. And it's all about like regulating your behavior around what you shouldn't do.
Whereas God said you shouldn't even think about it. And the point is the root, right? The heart, the brain, not the action.
Well, it's like, what's the more important thing to do? Control your own behavior, or go and do the work of God. If your behavior is harmful to others, absolutely, that's part of the equation. But, you know, I've been reading Romans for the last month, and, you know, Paul talks about it brilliantly. Like, I have freedom to do anything in Christ. I have ultimate freedom. My sin debt has been paid. Does that mean I should go on sinning? Absolutely not, because I'm not a slave to it. It has no authority over me. But I think the modern church, to the extent that it is even following the gospel, is playing small ball. And it's frankly, and this was my experience with our congregation that we went through, it's all about protecting the institution and the money. And it's disgusting. To me, it's as disgusting, and I do not mean this to be offensive to Catholics, but when I saw the new Pope come out on St. Peter's Square in all of his regalia to announce his ascension, and I saw that, I'm like, that is the furthest thing from Christ's church that I can imagine, right? Like, this is not the church that Christ established. And it's the same thing I would say to the American church. Like, what you're doing is turned it into a business where it's a bunch of self-help nonsense, and you could go into, I think 90% of the congregations in the U.S., whether that, you know, I don't care what denomination, what size, you went into 90% of the gospel, into the congregations on any given Sunday, you would not hear the gospel preached.
So I have the question. I'm trying to think exactly how to personify it, but I think it's ultimately, so how does one go about the pursuit of truth? That's the question. You know, in a world where let's say you're not wrong, because I don't know if you are. It's kind of the point that I sparked it, and here we are. But you know, these are a lot of people that follow the modern American church, Catholicism, and it's not a knock to any of them either. I would say that's not the point that you're trying to get at.
Correct.
But the point they're trying to get at. The point that I'm trying to get at now is to the person listening, right? Whoever mm-hmm. they are, wherever they are, Catholic, Christian, Mormon, atheist, right? How does, and they're questioning. They're like, I don't know. I don't think I've got the right answer. But obviously a lot of people don't, so whatever. How would they start that pursuit of truth? What does that direction look like? And how do we know? I mean, you and I, and this is kind of, I've found this interesting again and again and again. Somehow we're talking a truth that you and I intrinsically kind of know, to where we can use different words, different phrases, different concepts, and yet somehow just in this one-on-one conversation, I can somehow tell my spirit, whatever you want to call it, that we're like there. We're mm-hmm. having that conversation about some degree of truth, just a slice of it, a toenail or a finger.
I would answer that by saying there are many truths, right? There are many truths. There are also half-truths. Satan is an expert of using half-truths. Surely you will not die. It's where he started. And he continues with half-truths. But there's only one truth, and that is the person of Jesus. Yeshua Messiah, there is only one truth, complete truth. And the answer to that is that, and this is something I've come to fundamentally believe in the last few years, is like every person has to answer that question of who is the Nazarene named Yeshua. Who is he? You cannot ignore that question. You have to come to terms. You either believe what he said or you don't, but you don't get to ignore the question. And that's how you find truth, is you seek him, because he will give you the truth. You can start in the Gospels and read his words.
That's good. Is there anything in particular we didn't tackle? Like, I just feel like that's just kind of a beautiful summation sort of thing. So is there anything in particular we didn't quite tackle that you wanted to? We didn't quite hit the book. You want to hit the book?
No. I didn't really come with any expectation. So my expectations were met.
So formal wrap up ends in two questions. Okay. We have a saying around here. If we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Pop question for you.
Whose phrase was that? I've been trying to.
Yes. Astrophysicist. I figured, come on now.
I've known that.
The original quote, as it's modernly known, is if I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. And it was Isaac Newton.
Isaac Newton.
But I just found the phrase. I like the phrase. What's interesting to me is I'll go into a little bit more detail on this one. I do sometimes, but not often. It was like a priest that originally said it. I couldn't remember the exact phrasing. And then Isaac Newton twisted it. Well, what's even more interesting is the priest was referencing Greek mythology. There was a Titan blinded, a god that was, Zeus or someone had blinded a giant that was aspiring to too much. And so, the giant was like, look, I'm your son. What are you doing? Like, help me out here. You can't just put me into the world blind. And so Zeus gave him a dwarf, put him on his head, and the dwarf helped direct him. Why I'm bringing this up in its entirety now is because I love the origin of the phrase. It's just like the phrase lends to itself, how it's been iterated over and over and over. Who's been a giant in your life, Christian, that you would like to pay homage to in this moment?
Clock.
I know, it's perfect. Perfect timing. I was like, wow, what a clock.
I think it would be my grandmother, who diligently sought to introduce me to Christ. One of the most shameful things I've ever done was she was on her deathbed when I was 15. She asked me if I believed in Jesus, and I told her yes, because I didn't want her to be disappointed, but at the time I didn't. But it was her love for me that persisted, that kept me on that path and led me to Christ.
The second question is, if you had a bit of a pithy or general saying that you found to be true again and again for your life, what would that be? These are kind of those grasses always greener on the other side. Burn the boat. You referenced Burn the Boat with Ortiz.
One I like, I go to rather frequently, is beware the power of self-deception.
Beware the power of self-deception. I take that one. Thank you.
Yeah, like that's usually my answer of like, if you could go back and tell your 21-year-old self something, what would it be? And that would be it, because there has been so much of my life where I have just flat out lied to myself and didn't even know that I was doing it.
Well, the plateaus, get out of your own way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you, Christian. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
Bye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.